Great. And I want to welcome everyone who's joining us today. I'm Felicia Herman. I'm the Associate Editor of Sapir and Managing Director of the Maimonides Fund, which is a publisher of Sapir. And I'm really excited that I was able to talk Brett Stevens, our Editor-in-Chief, into letting me interview Rachel Kafferson today, because the topic is really one that is near and dear to me personally. And also for those of us who work in Jewish communal life, I think it's really a critical and under-discussed topic. And we really need to be talking about it. We need to be wrestling with it. We need to be thinking about concrete ways of moving forward. So these conversations with some of the authors in Sapir give us a chance to dive more deeply into the contents of their essays, into the ideas, and also to take the conversation off the page. And this is another reason why I wanted to talk to Rachel, because I've been following your work on Tablet for so long, and just to have the opportunity to really talk about Yiddish and culture and the Jewish future with you is just really exciting, because we want Sapir to be a catalyst. It's not supposed to be the last word on anything. It's supposed to be the beginning or the next step in an ongoing conversation. And we're really delighted to be building a roster of authors who aren't just thinkers, but they're also doers like you. And we're not just analyzing ideas and arguments. We're really trying to address the challenges and opportunities that that come up in these articles in Sapir. So I'm delighted to introduce everybody to Rachel Kafferson, who's a journalist and a playwright, who writes a twice monthly column in Tablet magazine called Rachel's Golden City that has been running for many years now, which is amazing. You have to publish a book, I think, of all of it at some point. She's a 2022 winner of the prestigious Dreaming in Yiddish Award, and her beautiful piece in the latest issue of Sapir is called The Jewish Future Needs Yiddish. And as we will get into, it makes the case for the critical importance of Yiddish for the language, for the culture, for the civilization of Yiddish land, as I see it often referred to, that all of this is critical for understanding the Jewish past, but also for engaging Jews in the present and for building a really vibrant and diverse Jewish future. So Rachel, I have to say first that I love this piece for so many reasons, not the least of which is that I completely agree with you that we need to take Yiddish more seriously. I don't always agree with everything in Sapir, but with this one, it was like right on. And I maybe am emblematic of people on the call, maybe not. I grew up with just, I would say, like sort of whispers of Yiddish in the background. And of course, the, you know, relatives who knew Yiddish maybe to some degree, but for whom it wasn't an active and alive thing. And of course, the ways that Yiddish expressions have just made their way into mainstream Jewish culture, even American culture, American Jewish life. But I was so compelled by your piece because when I actually started studying Yiddish in graduate school, it just opened up an entire civilization to me that had been off limits, and not off limits like you can read about it, but like it just brought it alive in a way that it had never been alive before. And it was really important to us to have a piece about Yiddish in this issue of Sapir that's all about culture, because language and food and music and poetry and film, all of that is what really brings a civilization to life. So we are, we're just excited. Let's just get started. So I would love to know from you how you got interested in all of this. What's your story? Where do you come from? And where does Yiddish start figuring into your life?
Okay. Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. And so I think this is a really good starting point. I grew up on Long Island. I'm an 80s kid. And I grew up in what I think is a fairly typical American Jewish milieu, which is that all four of my grandparents were born in the United States. Both of my parents grew up in very rooted communities, my dad in Philly, my mom in Allentown, where they were surrounded by grandparents, their grandparents who had come from Eastern Europe, their aunts and uncles, many of them, their cousins, right? So they grew up in these very rooted, full of family kind of environments in which Yiddish was, you know, part of the ambiance, right? It was in the air. It was not something that people generally felt needed to be systematically translated. You know, I just saw my dad last night, and we told the story, or I insisted my dad tell the story, how he grew up in Philly in a neighborhood called Logan. And, you know, his parents sent him to a shtiebel where he learned Chumash Midrashi, which means he learned Torah with Rashi's commentary. And yet, you know, when he got called up to the Bima for his bar mitzvah, he didn't know what his Jewish name was. Or the rabbi with whom he, the Eastern European rabbi with whom he'd been studying, didn't know. And, you know, his parents had sent him to the shtiebel because, frankly, it was inexpensive and it was just something you did. But, like, they were not religious. Like, they sent him to this very, very traditional learning environment that already was kind of disconnected for what was going on in their home. Okay. Then both of my parents left those very rooted communities, ended up on Long Island. So I grew up without extended family. I did not know my grandparents, and I had a very, very different experience than they did, because I grew up in a place where the air was very different, that there were many, many Jews. I grew up in an incredibly Jewish environment, and that it was full of Jews, but it was not full of those tangible personal links to the past, both individual and on a larger sense. I did not grow up with any kind of larger Jewish culture. What I grew up with was my parents also sent me to a Jewish learning experience, which was disconnected from what happened at our home, right? But in a very different way. So they sent me to a very typical American, you know, capital C conservative Hebrew school. And I learned things, and to me, this is the emblematic experience that in my Hebrew school, there was a poster on the wall that said, Laila Tov, good night, and Boker Tov, good morning. And, you know, those were things that felt kind of strangely disconnected, because at my house, one of the little whispers of Yiddish that remained was when my mom would say goodnight to me, she would say, Geishlofen. Now, what did Geishlofen mean? I don't know. She never explained it. It was just sort of a thing you said at night. But I knew, I didn't think it could be Jewish, because according to my Hebrew school, to the poster on the wall, you say, Laila Tov.
Right.
It was just one of those things. So, you know, I learned like very minimal Jewish skills at my Hebrew school. I was taught modern Hebrew Israeli pronunciation by the way, my teacher was a Polish Holocaust survivor, which must have been, I think, kind of strange for her, you know, and I do wish that I knew more about, you know, her experience as a teacher, because we were not good students and people were not interested in learning. I mean, that's the classic Hebrew school experience. So I left Hebrew school. I was not a good student. I didn't enjoy it. In fact, I didn't have my bas mitzvah at that time. I sort of like did all the steps, and then I was, you know, a very kind of a contrarian kid. And I said, no, I sort of at the last minute, like I left them at the altar, as it were. I did not have my bus mitzvah when I was 13. Yeah. I had an adult bus mitzvah at 31, which we can get to in a little bit. So then a couple of years later, it just so happened that I was in high school at the moment that the sort of second wave of the Klezmer revival was at its peak. And what that means is that, you could turn on NPR and hear klezmer music. And now 25, you know, something, 30 years later, I kind of marvel at this, right? That Garrison Keillor, for whatever reason, you know, Garrison Keillor was an important vehicle for transmitting and popularizing all kinds of non-mainstream American musics that were happening at that time, one of which was klezmer. So my dad was an NPR listener, and we happened to live in a town that had a fairly good independent bookstore with a world music section. Again, this is very 90s. Nobody CDs. Uses the word anymore. But, you know, let's give props to whoever invented the world music category, because I think it facilitated the discovery for a lot of people of many interesting kinds of music that they wouldn't have heard otherwise. So my dad was in the bookstore and he saw the klezmer category. He heard it on NPR and he brought home a Klezmatics CD. Now, let me say before I go any further that a lot of the story has to do with me and my, you know, the way that I understand the world. And as a kid, I was obsessed with music and I still am. I'm not really such a great musician, but my identity was formed through music. You know, I had Beatles posters on my wall. I was obsessed with the British invasion, the Who and the Rolling Stones, the Beatles. And I heard this CD. I was just knocked over. Okay. Well, first of all, it's great music, but I thought, wait, this is Jewish music? This is Jewish music? You know, all the reactions you can have because nobody had told me such a thing existed. And it's not Israeli, it's Jewish. Imagine my little tiny, 16-year-old brain trying to wrap itself around this. There were Yiddish words, and I was like, wait, Yiddish? I sort of think I know what this is because of the person that I am. I immediately started grilling my parents. I said, wait, what Yiddish words do you know? So I, start writing them down. Then occasionally we would see we would go to Philly, for example, and I would see, relatives that I didn't see very often. I would say, do you know any Yiddish words? I would write them down. I became obsessed. And I like to say that a dybbuk came into me because I needed to know all of it. And this was in the pre-internet era. So it was really hard to track down information. I ended up going to Brandeis, which at that time was one of the very few schools where you could actually study Yiddish language. And it was, from there, it's never stopped, basically. The obsession has grown. It was, in a sense, a reaction, right, to the place where I grew up, which had a very thick sense of Jewish identity in the sense that I knew I was Jewish. I grew up around Jews. I had a very, traumatic Holocaust education. So I understood that there was something serious at stake, right? That being Jewish was not like a light thing that you could just say, oh yeah, I'm Jewish and whatever. It was, in a lot of ways, a matter of life and death, right? But that I didn't know what it meant, how to do it. And, my parents were not terribly interested in observance, and frankly, neither was I. So I just always assumed that there was no other way to be Jewish. And then when I started learning Yiddish, it was like, again, so many moments of having my mind blown and understanding how rich and how much more expansive Jewishness was, right? Because you learn the word Yiddishkeit. Well, what does Yiddishkeit mean? It means an entire civilization. It means a way of approaching life. It means all of these things, 1,000 years packed into a language. And I just started learning things about my own experience that started making sense. For example, like I said, my dad grew up going to the shtiebel where he learned with a traditional teacher. He learned Chumash Midrashi. And my dad, when we would light, let's say, Hanukkah candles at home, and he would say the blessings, he would say the brachas, and he said them in a way that growing up, I thought, why is he? My dad is a bit of a contrarian too. I get it from him. And I always thought, God, he's saying the blessings wrong. It's so annoying. Why is he saying it like this? And then when I learned Yiddish, you learn Kometz Aleph, Pasach Aleph Ah, Kometz Aleph O, right?
Right.
I realized my dad was saying Kometz Aleph O when he said, like, Boruch Ato. Who says that? Well, now I knew who says that, right? That my dad was coming from this very rooted place, but he didn't have the vocabulary to explain that. And it never even occurred to me to ask him why. It just seemed weird, right? Because there was a dissonance between what I was learning how to be a Jew at Hebrew school and how I learned to be a Jew at home seemed to be, these slight differences added up to an enormous sense of confusion. And learning Yiddish really helped me resolve that confusion in a way that I've now spent the last 20, 25 years trying to transmit to other people.
it's so interesting to listen to you contrast your experience in Hebrew school with your self-directed experience of learning Yiddish, because the Yiddish piece feels so alive. And just the way you described Hebrew school, which of course is not unique, although I personally liked Hebrew school, but it feels so dead. And even, your Hebrew teacher, that's such a great sort of compelling hook here. Like, she grew up speaking Yiddish, no doubt, right? And so, but here she was teaching Hebrew, and teaching Hebrew with Israeli pronunciation, not Polish or Yiddish inflections, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
it's
absolutely.
It's a really interesting, I know that we'll get into this, but it's a really interesting thing to think about, you know, structurally, if we were to bring Yiddish into Jewish education, into Hebrew school or into day schools or something, what, how the experience might be different. And then it's also, I think, really important to hear you tell this story of how you discovered Yiddish was actually through music. So we've also, you know, you can, when you work in Jewish philanthropy, you get to meet a lot of different people sort of coming through the door with their ideas. And there are people who say, you know, the best way to learn Hebrew is through learning music, or the best way to engage people in Israel is by translating Israeli songs and getting young people in, you know, through the things that they actually care about, like music. So.
Absolutely. One of my dear friends grew up going to, I think it was Ramah, and, you know, he always talks about how one of the things they did during the summer was they performed Greece in Hebrew.
Right.
You know,
right.
Translation. And right. I mean, it's kind of funny, but the truth is, like, his Hebrew is excellent.
Yeah.
And I really wish, you know, that I had the kind of, you know, substantive Hebrew education that he did. And right. It's true. Like, do I think that translating, you know, something like Greece into Hebrew is really the best use of their time, you know, Jewishly? I'm not sure. But, you know, the principle, I think, remains that we need, you know, the cultural aspect, right, is so important to education, because without it, it's dry, it's dead, it's dusty, nobody wants it, you know?
Yeah, fascinating. All right, well, let's talk about your essay for a few minutes. And I can't tell you how many people have said to me, oh my God, I had no idea about that dreidel story. So it was really the perfect example for you to hook your article around. So tell us the story of the dreidel that you tell in the article, and, you know, not just the story of it, but really what it tells us about the erasure of Yiddish culture and what might happen if we bring all of that back.
So, you know, we have to go all the way back to actually late antiquity. And let me preface this by saying that we don't have a lot of good documentation about many of these things, because these were aspects of history which for a long time were not considered important. And there's very, very little documentation. So I'm certainly not an expert on these things, but I'm going to tell you, to the best of my ability and, you know, the documentation we do have, this seems to be what happened, is that, you know, think of dice, right? Mm-hmm. Dice also as a material object that people play games with and have, you know, and also used for things like divination. These are objects that have a very, very long history. And the spinning top with things written on the sides is also very ancient. Mm-hmm. And as best we know, it does, this object, which has, let's say, four sides and spins and has a little stem, goes back to late Roman times. And that was the way it diffused into Europe, right? Because obviously the Roman Empire was spread all over. And we know that it was called in Latin a teetotum. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so totem T, there was one of the letters that was written on the side. So like the dreidel, it had a letter on each side, and the letter stood for a Latin word, which told you what to do. If it landed on the T totem, right, you would take all. And if you landed on the N, the nilio, you took nothing, right? So this diffused all over Europe. It changes, it gets adapted into various cultures. And we believe that it got adapted, the Jews adapted it in the Rhineland area, you know, we would say Germany today, as a trendel, you know, a trendel, something that spins. Hmm. And that was the German name. And then it diffused from there, right? So these are important concepts for Jewish culture in general, right? Is cultural contact and cultural diffusion. Because cultures are always in contact.
Right.
So we don't have a ton of documentation about the Jewish dreidel. Now, one of the things that I learned when I was writing the article, and this really blew my mind, I thought this was so interesting, is that there is, I found this book from the early 1800s, which was a guide, it was in English, it was published in England, a guide to contemporary games, like, you know, board games and parlor games. And they described a game called Put and Take, which used a teetotum. And the rules are basically exactly like dreidel, right? Put and take. You put in one or you take one, depending, you know, you spin a four-sided top and the rules are essentially the same. So we know that this was a game that was being played certainly in England and probably in other places. I found a collector online, somebody who collects antique teetotums and various iterations from all over the world, especially Germany and England. So we know that this continued to be very popular and also kind of a fun thing to collect, right? You can make it in many different materials. There are ones made out of bone and ivory. The one that I talk about in the piece, oftentimes Jewish dreidels were made out of cast lead, right? Mm-hmm. And cast lead is really a perfect material to make something like this because it melts really easily. Pretty much anybody with access to, you know, a little bit of lead and a mold can make them. And then when Hanukkah is over, you know, you just use it for something else. It's the perfectly, you know, recyclable game, which is really beautiful, I think. And somebody, there's a memoir, I don't know if this made it into the piece, there's a memoir that I really love. Oh, it's a Michael Gelbart's memoir, mm-hmm. where he says that, you know, the guy came into town at Hanukkah time and he, you know, made dreidels. Mm-hmm. And they're also, you know, they're very light, they're easy to spin, they're perfect. So the thing is about the dreidel, because it has come down to us and has become the emblematic symbol of Hanukkah, it kind of has pushed to the side the fact that actually Hanukkah was one of the times in the year when traditional Jews were permitted to gamble. Mm-hmm. So dreidel was just one example of that. And that was for, you know, mostly for kids, right? And they would play for nuts. And again, this was generally in the English description that I referenced before, this was a game that you would play with nuts, right? You put a nut in, you took a nut out. However, cards were really the adult gambling game of choice. And gambling and especially playing cards was always highly controversial in Jewish communities because obviously people wanted to do it. You know, human beings, we love to gamble. Card games are also quite old and people have been playing them for a long time and they've also always been controversial. You know, I'm sure the church also has a frowns on gambling. So you can find, gamble to say that you find more descriptions of card games and the dangers of playing cards, especially around Hanukkah, than you would find playing dreidel. Like dreidel just wasn't that interesting. It was just one of many, let's say, you know, aspects of traditional Jewish life. So what was written on a Jewish dreidel, right? So it actually mirrored the teetotum letters, you know, Nun, Gimel, Shin, Hey. What's so interesting to me is the sort of fake lore, you know, invented backstories that have arisen to explain what these letters are, because as American Jews underwent this cultural amnesia, right, of forgetting what those letters meant in Yiddish because the use of Yiddish diminished, we were left with instructions to a game that we could no longer access, right? Yeah. So into that void then, of course, because this is a very human impulse, is to explain them and to adapt it once again to new purposes, right? So let me just say that there is, within Jewish culture, you find this definitely within Hebrew language culture, but you also find it within Yiddish, is that Jews love acronyms, Rosh HaTevis, okay? Mm-hmm. They love it, acrostics, you know, like if you're in shul, PU, like the first letter spells this guy's name. You're like, how come they kept doing this? This was just part of Jewish culture. People love that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of both jokey, you know, acronyms. Somebody once, I saw somebody say that, you know, people would describe like, oh, if you spoke, like very kind of bad or, you know, degraded Yiddish, you spoke Speck Yiddish. So Speck meaning bacon, and Speck standing for Schmuck Putz. Schmuck Putz.
Probably shouldn't tell us the last one. I don't know.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, that's kind of a vulgar one, but there are a lot of these. What happens is that you also then see at that moment, and this happens actually very early. I saw a text recently where this was going back all the way actually to the early 1900s, 1910s, I think 1920s, where you have the nascent American Zionist movement here in the United States co-opt these letters to for this saying that we now know, right? Neskadol Hayasha, like a great miracle happened there. This is a very, very, very modern spin, if you will, on what those letters mean. And what happens is that because nobody is sitting there recording, like, oh, at this moment, somebody decided to repurpose those letters, like, it's, you know, there's no documentation of that. So we just assume, well, okay, that's just the way it is. But in fact, I'm waiting for a grad student to do this. I bet you can go back and, you know, find the moment when that happens and how it diffuses into popular culture. And so you see that, and that just accelerates sort of the amnesia around the dreidel and why those letters were there, and they get put to new uses. So I hesitate to say right or wrong, you know, oh, this is wrong or whatever, but that it's more that we have to understand that the material objects in, that populate our Jewish life and our Jewish lives have their own lives and their own histories.
So the reason why this is such a perfect example is because the Hebrew letters, the Hebrew explanation for the letters makes absolutely no sense if you're trying to use the dreidel to play a game, right? And then when you learn the Yiddish and you're like, oh, that actually makes sense. That's telling me to put in or to take out or to have or whatever. And I think that this is, it's emblematic of the story that you're telling, that sometimes, you know, whether it's the Hebrew or Jewish religious sort of, maybe we could contrast it sort of like high culture, low culture, or like official history, social history, or folk history. What you're talking about is a folk history, and the lives of the material objects and the languages that people spoke, often the languages that women spoke, right? We know that there's a whole gendered element to this too, of Yiddish versus Hebrew, and who knew Hebrew versus who knew Yiddish, and who prayed in Hebrew versus who prayed in Yiddish. And I wonder, maybe you can tell us more about why you think this has all happened. So you have a line in the piece, and I'm going to interrupt myself for 1 second just because I keep forgetting to say that people can put questions into the Q&A, and at about 15 minutes, we'll turn to the Q&A. But till then, I have you all to myself. So you say in here that something about, you know, if you were to walk into a Jewish day school or even to a Hebrew school in a synagogue and suggest that they start speaking, that they start teaching Yiddish, that you'd be laughed out of the room. Meanwhile, you're telling us personally a story that like Yiddish brought everything alive for you. So tell us what's the disconnect? Why do you think it's fallen away? Why do we have amnesia now over something that used to be for Ashkenazi Jews, the language that everybody knew and spoke? And most of our ancestors, most American Jews are Ashkenazi.
Yeah. Well, so first of all, that's actually a true anecdote that a friend of mine told me. And so this friend is a very high level Jewish studies professor. In fact, he teaches Yiddish literature. And he was touring Jewish day schools. I guess they had moved to the Midwest, and he was touring day schools, and he, you know, asked, because it is his field, he said, oh, so do you teach any Yiddish literature? And he meant like even just in translation. And the woman looked at him and laughed. She said, well, how would we do that? You know, the implication being that, like, you know, as if this was rocket science, or even that, like, the idea is absurd, because, you know, I've always wanted to write a book called The Myth of the Yiddish Atlantis, right? The idea that this is a culture that is so utterly inaccessible, so extinct and inaccessible, that we might as well be trying to teach Atlantis, right? It's under the waters, it's gone for thousands of years, it was punished by the gods, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's gone. So how on earth would we teach it? So I think that the problem, the disconnect, is that even people who are Jewish educators, you know, who know a tremendous amount about Jewish culture and Jewish religion and Jewish life, don't realize that these things are in fact quite accessible, whether in the original or in translation. So if you just assume, because our ambient culture tells us that Yiddish is dead, that it's inaccessible, then it would never occur to you that it's even possible. right? And I think that's the disconnect, that everything in our culture tells us that Yiddish is dead, which is why, to be honest with you, I don't like the term Yiddish revival. Because, you know, in order for something to be revived, it has to be dead, first of all, and that's not true. I would much prefer we talk about Yiddish continuity. I think that's a much better framework.
That's great.
And also, if we talk about a Yiddish revival, or we talk about Yiddish being dead, it kind of, you know, it takes the focus off what matters, right? It says, well, we don't have to feel bad, or we don't have to feel guilty because it's dead and there's really nothing we can do. So let's move on, you know.
Did you also write about internalized shame, right? Immigrants having internalized shame. And I'm thinking about that Philip Roth story, Eli the Fanatic. Remember that short story, right? Where the Orthodox guy moves into the very assimilated, you know, probably middle-class Jewish neighborhood, and the Jews themselves are so shocked and horrified by this guy who walks around with I don't remember if he was a yarmulke or a hat or whatever it was, like how Orthodox he was. It probably wasn't that Orthodox. So there's got to be something, if you think about, you know, your own life and growing up in Long Island, I grew up in New Jersey, same thing. Like, they moved to those places to get away from the place where the air was Jewish or Yiddish or whatever it was. So there was we could say it was escaping shame. It was also a striving, and striving meant leaving Yiddish behind.
Absolutely. You know, of course, people wanted to be American. You know, they wanted to speak English. And, you know, the appearing too Jewish had real material consequences. You know, if you applied, okay, right. One of the quintessential Americanizing jobs was getting a job as a teacher in the New York City school system.
Right.
Just like today, like getting a job with the federal government, these are all paths to the middle class. So in order to get one of those teaching jobs, you had to get rid of your accent. And people did. Like, there were real, you know, ways you could go to a teacher, you could get a friend to help you, but they were not going to hire you if you're English was accented, right? Which, if you sounded too Jewish. So these are real material consequences, just, you know, first off, to being too Jewish. So of course people are going to internalize that, and, you know, you can't blame them, right?
Right.
In addition to the fact that there are so many other layers to that kind of shame, and the fact that Yiddish then becomes, it has this second life in American Jewish comedy, where, you know, you tell a dirty joke and then the punchline is always in Yiddish. So the association with the lowbrow and the vulgar certainly did not help Yiddish to have much respect. And then, especially with the Holocaust, there's a whole nother set of associations. You know, I've heard people say things just very kind of unselfconsciously, people my age who say, you know, when I hear the soft, right? Like, someone say, instead of saying brachot, you say brachas. So yeah. People will say, like, when I hear that soft, I feel so uncomfortable. It makes me think of victims. It makes me think of old people being killed in the Holocaust. And, you know, that's a very upsetting thing to hear, because it's, first of all, sad that people have internalized that and they feel that way about their own grandparents, or like, you know, to feel that way about people that you do care about, but yet to feel this mixture of like shame and anger and revulsion, right? When you hear that, and that because they are, you know, there are so many associations with Israeli Hebrew as being something that will keep you safe, that is about having your own home. And I've seen so many of these expressions in the wild that I understand the psychological phenomenon. And I don't blame people for feeling that way. But if you don't teach people, if all you're doing is learning it on the street, as it were, right, then of course you're going to grow up with these ideas and internalize all of them. So that's why it's all the more important to teach people actually, you know, what Yiddish is, how it lived, not how it died, but how it lived for 1,000 years. And, you know, well, maybe we're going to get to this in the next question, but I think this is, again, very relevant to Holocaust education, but I'll wait till we get there.
Well, and I was just going to say that the shame, there's like yet another element of it today, where the people who are most visibly speaking Yiddish today are ultra-Orthodox Jews, about whom I think a lot of non-ultra-Orthodox Jews have a lot of shame and embarrassment. So it doesn't help. It's sort of like the one community that we know super visibly has kept it alive, and then I want to ask you about everybody else, but is a community that most Jews, American Jews, don't really want to have anything to do with. So
yes, it's a very, very complicated thing that people, when they see, Haredi people speaking Yiddish, it brings up a very complicated set of feelings. Absolutely.
Yeah. Back to that Philip Roth story. But as you're saying, there's not just a Jewish revival or a Yiddish revival, there's Yiddish continuity. There's actually an incredibly rich culture, subculture, I don't know what you would call it, counterculture almost, of Yiddish organizations in North America, around the world, but a lot in North America. Before I was at the Maimonides Fund, I was running a foundation called Natan that funds startups, organizational startups. And every now and then, every couple of years, we would see another Yiddish organization come along, a Yiddish farm or a Yiddish camp or a Yiddish music thing. So tell us about that world, because I'm guessing that most people know very little about it. So it's not just YIVO, and the National Yiddish Book Center was sort of the big institutions in this world, but there are many different kinds of things going on.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that you mentioned YIVO and the Yiddish Book Center, because they first of all represent sort of two poles, if you will, around which so much of Yiddish life revolves. They're very different, but also overlap in certain ways, but also they represent both the continuity of these legacy organizations. YIVO was founded in 1925 in Vilna in Lithuania, which was then Poland. And then you have the Yiddish Book Center, which is, basically my age, right? And was born of, this sort of much later interest in Yiddish and a reaction to, previous generations' diminishment of Yiddish and desire to leave it behind. So in New York, you have a whole layer of legacy organizations. So you have the Congress for Jewish Culture, the Albert Lecher Yiddisher Congress, which is an organization that's now very, very small. It used to be much larger, hence the name Congress, Albert Lecher, the Global Yiddish Congress, which was founded in 1948. My friend Shane Baker is the executive director. You have the League for Yiddish, the Yiddish Ligue, which was originally associated with a territorialist political movement, but which was associated with Dr. Schechter, who was a very, very important part of the Yiddish standardization project. And Jugendruf, which was a youth project of the League for Yiddish, Jugendruf, which means call to youth. And so there's a whole bunch of legacy Yiddish organizations, both here in New York and around the world too. You had the Workman's Circle, which was also a worldwide phenomenon in certain ways, but really concentrated here in New York. And in my own personal life, I moved to New York City in 1997, and a lot of Yiddish life still revolved around this really dumpy old building on 45 East 33rd Street, a big building in which you had the Volksbühne, you had the Vorwärts, had so many organizations. And when there was a fire drill, this was the best, because I worked at the Volksbühne for a while. The fire drill, everybody would come out on the street and be like, oh, hey, I didn't know you were here. Like if something happened to that building, it would really affect the future of Yiddish in America, because everybody was there. And, you didn't often even know it. So there is that world of Yiddish, but you also have, to me, probably the most important phenomenon really is Klez Camp, and it's many kind of, I don't want to say imitators, but its successor organizations, right? Because Klez Camp actually ended its, I think, 30-year history in 2015. So Klez Camp, when it started, it was sort of a bunch of Jewish people who were all kind of peers who were involved in both the American old-time music, like bluegrass music movement, and Balkan music. Okay. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, it's kind of the weird, you know, wrinkles of history that the modern Balkan music scene is so important to the development of, you know, mm-hmm. the revival, if you will, of Jewish klezmer music. Mm-hmm. So those folks were used to going to Balkan camp. During the summer, you would go and hang out for 5 or 6 days and you would learn and everybody would eat together and dance and there would be jams. So when Henry Sapoznik, Lawrence Glamberg, and Adrian Cooper were all working at Evo in the early 80s, and these were all people who had experience at these camps, whether old time music or Balkan, they decided to make something for Yiddish and Jewish music. Hmm. So you had Klez Camp, and it was immediately, you know, it filled such an obvious void. Then you had imitators. You had Buffalo on the Roof, which happened for a couple of years in Virginia. And then Klez Canada, came along a couple years later, which happens in the Laurentian Mountains outside of Montreal. So for me, Klez Camp and Klez Canada were it, because it was a week that you spent learning intensively, connecting with teachers, connecting with your peers, and then you learn things and you take it back to your own community. Hmm. And I've been saying now for a long time that there really needs to be a detailed long-term ethnographic study of the thousands of young people who have participated in these festivals. They then started having them in St. Petersburg and in Eastern Europe, all, you know, everywhere, because people respond to culture, right? It's for many reasons. It is an entry point that is so important and that we really need to be understanding, right? Because it's such a vibrant phenomenon.
And I think that's what's so notable about all the programs, at least that I would see come over the Transomit Natan, is they were all young people. It was not just older people who knew Yiddish, you know, it really, there's a huge vibrancy among the resonance of Yiddish, you know, people resonate with Yiddish, young people too. So I want to turn to the questions that are coming in from the audience. We have a few. And one of the ones that it's really, there are two actually that are about names, Yiddish names. And it just reminded me that one of the story that somebody tells in one of the questions, she says that it's anonymous, learned that my parents don't have Hebrew names, they have Yiddish names, drove me crazy trying to find out their Hebrew names. And they told me that they thought it was Hebrew, but I now know that it was Yiddish. So the same thing happened to me. My Hebrew name that I had to give when I was in Hebrew school is Bluma, which mm-hmm. is my grandmother's name. And I remember whatever it was, first or second grade, the Hebrew school teacher saying to me in this like tone that I still remember, like, that's not Hebrew, but that's my name, it's Bluma. And there is something so beautiful. You mentioned the, you know, bar mitzvah and your father getting up, you know, what's your Hebrew name and not knowing it. Like, it is so beautiful when I go, when I have my kids bar mitzvahs or my niece and nephew, to have the Yiddish names and the Hebrew names sort of all coming together. It tells you the story of the family. So what about you? When did you start calling yourself Rachel instead of Rachel, which I'm guessing was your name?
Can you see I have my name earrings on?
Wow, that is pretty amazing.
So, you know, when you take a foreign language class, right, the teacher will encourage you to take a French name or an Italian name or whatever. Yes. And so obviously, if you have a Lashon Kodesh name, it's easy to just become, you know, Rachel becomes Rachel. So it became Rachel. And, you know, I really liked it. And I have to tell you that I never really loved the name Rachel. I found it kind of, you know, not very euphonious. It's like Rachel, you know, it doesn't rhyme with anything. Nobody writes a song about Rachel. And, you know, I liked it in other iterations. I liked Rachel or Raquel. I didn't like Rachel. Hmm. And also, you know, I was named after my grandmother, Rose, whose Hebrew name or her Yiddish name, her Jewish name was Rachel. And I liked that, you know, tangible connection to her. Hmm. And then I really loved, you know, as I went on, that seeing other women named Rachel, right, you know, Yiddish poets or historians, and, you know, I felt a tangible connection to them. I never really felt mm-hmm. connected to anybody named Rachel. Hmm. And it just felt right. You know, it's one of those things, again, like sort of the Dybbuk going into me, that made a lot of sense.
It's really, really interesting. The earrings are really So somebody else asks, regarding Jewish education and engagement, should Yiddish be taught as part of a broader curriculum alongside other dialects? Or do you see another approach? Like, is there a zero-sum game for Jewish languages, do you think?
Well, so, you know, here's the thing where we really have to address our positionality as Americans, okay? We live in, you know, where's the hegemony? You know, we're soaking in it, right? Like, everybody around the world just happens to speak English, which is very convenient for us, because we don't need to learn other languages. So we exist within a deeply, deeply monolingual cultural matrix. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are lots of other languages are spoken in this country, but our relationship to those other languages, as well as our relationship to the concept of bilingualism or multilingualism, is highly politicized, to say the least, and, you know, kind of troubling. Whereas in other places, you know, you travel to Europe, like everybody just naturally speaks, of course, they speak English as well as their native language and maybe others. And this was certainly the context for Jewish life, you know, as, you know, there's a book about that I really enjoy called, you know, internal trilingualism of, you know, Jewish life. And that's not the exact title, it's in English, but, you know, traditionally Jewish life has been multilingual, right? So the problem is that learning another language is difficult. And it's all the more difficult when you are in a society where learning another language and becoming bilingual goes against our very deeply held core values. So that's hard. And I think that before we can even have those conversations, we have to understand our own sort of unspoken or unarticulated biases against second languages, against integrating other languages, right? I think it's very possible to have a day school curriculum where you have intensive Hebrew as well as heritage languages. You could be Yiddish, it could be Ladino. I mean, I'm a language maximalist, and you know, the way I use that term, it means that it's not a zero-sum game, that Jewish life desperately needs Jewish literacy, top level. Second level, we need literacy, Lashon Kodesh, Hebrew Aramaic literacy. And then the next level is we need modern language Jewish literacy. So that's modern Hebrew, Yiddish, Ladino, all these heritage languages. Now, the exact formulation is going to be different for different communities. But, you know, it's very, very possible. We Yiddish, having left the largest body of literature and the largest number of speakers, is, you know, it's pretty obvious, right? And I think it can be integrated very easily. And you can look to other communities where they're still pretty serious about it. For example, in Australia, in Melbourne, Yiddish is very well integrated into the Jewish schools there. I mean, not as much as it used to be, but compared to the United States, I mean, it's a totally different ballgame.
Well, Montreal as well, right?
Montreal as well. It's a little bit different. They have the Bialik school, and a number of heritage schools there where Yiddish was also taken very seriously. And both in Montreal and Melbourne, because you had the presence of such a high number of Holocaust survivors who ended up settling there, that also, ironically, injected new life into their schools and into their sort of educational, programs, into the, what they thought was important.
It's interesting also, I think it shows us what the languages that we teach tell us what we think is important, right? So if we're teaching Hebrew, and I'm an enthusiastic supporter of teaching Hebrew, it gives us access to Judaism as a religion, it gives us access to text, it gives us access to prayer. But if we're teaching, so then you have to say, well, why would I learn Yiddish? But Yiddish gives you access to history and to the people, right? And to literature and poetry, and again, like prayers and women's lives. And you just have to say that those things are actually important to you, if you know, before you decide to start teaching them.
Absolutely. I think that's a really great point. And, you know, something, a concept that I use a lot in my teaching these days is the great tradition versus the little tradition. This is a sociological concept. So we can think of what we think of as Judaism, right, as our core texts, our, Tanakh, Gemara, Mishnah, rabbinic responsum, right? These are the great tradition, and we think of a man with a beard, and of course they're incredibly important. And this is the way globally that, you know, Jewishness, it has been diffused. However, in each place, Judaism gets lived in a hyper-local, personal, individual way. And those are the little traditions, right? And that's what I'm very interested in the Ashkenazi context, because it's there that you find a ton of women's roles, women's lives. Women are able to take on those leadership roles within the community, but in ways that unfortunately don't get passed on, right? They're not considered important. They're not, oftentimes not recorded in texts and not transmitted. And, you know, they become very hard to access later on, but not impossible.
Okay, let's go to a couple more questions. So there are a bunch that are about pronunciation. And I remember a friend of mine who's father was a Holocaust survivor doing Kiddush for the first time that I heard in his Polish, you know, his Polish intonated version of Hebrew. And it was like a language I had never heard of before. So one person observes here that academic Yiddish is different than Hasidic Yiddish, and that YIVO tried very hard, as you were referencing before, to try to standardize pronunciation for Yiddish. So if we had, we won't call it a Yiddish revival, if many more people were studying Yiddish, what Yiddish would they learn? Do you think the Galician, the Russian, the Lithuanian, the classical?
Well, you know, we have one data point on this, which is very interesting, which is the phenomenon of Duolingo.
Okay.
And Duolingo has been developed with Hasidish pronunciations, Hasidish spellings, Hasidish grammar as sort of a starting point. And this is not an uncontroversial, position to take. I mean, it makes sense, you know, their thought process makes sense, okay? Because a lot of the people, not all of them, but a lot of the people developing it are people who are native Hasidic Yiddish speakers. So I'll tell you, this is a bit of a controversial hot button topic, right? Like if we are going to have a serious conversation about how to transmit Yiddish, how to teach Yiddish, how to integrate it into more of a, you know, mainstream, our general Jewish lives here in America, well, whose Yiddish are we transmitting? You know, it's a really good question. I have to say that I personally fall on the side of the normalizers, the normirers, as we would say in Yiddish, right, of YIVO, that, look, what they did was, you know, something that was very modern and in a sense kind of artificial. We can agree to that, we can stipulate to that and still say that it serves many important functions. I think that what you can do is start by giving people basic literacy tools and use YIVO standards and use even YIVO, you know, sort of this northern central pronunciation, this sort of pseudo-Lithuanian pronunciation. And then you can contextualize other kinds of Yiddish because they naturally will come up. If you learn, for example, if you do things with Yiddish theater or Yiddish theater songs, you'll notice that things were written so that they rhyme, but they rhyme in ways that are not, you know, YIVO standard, okay? Or if you just, you know, if you start to, if you read Yiddish newspapers today, you know, it'll be different. Or you talk to Hasidim today, their Yiddish is going to be different. So I don't think it's a, you know, it is the conversation stopper that maybe sometimes people think it is. I think that you have to make a decision to begin with and then give people tools to go further and explore it, you know, if they want. I mean, look, in general, my feeling is that we need to be really conscientious about not looking for one solution for the Jewish future, because there is no one Jewish future, there's no one Jewish answer, and there's no one Judaism, and there never has been, right? This is like our mistaken monism, right? Like our mistaken sort of overinvestment in these traditional metaphors about the Jewish people, like, you know, Das Yiddische Volk and Knesset Yisrael, right? This idea that there is one Jewish people, Am Yisrael Chai, right? Like the Jewish people lives. It's, I mean, these things are both true and sort of cover up the complexity. So once we accept the multiplicity of Jewish culture, the multiplicity of Jewish peoples, it becomes easier because you can present one point of view and then give people tools to explore further, right? And we can also structure things in a way that can affirm that what we're teaching won't necessarily reflect the reality or the experience, the lived experience of each person learning it. And I think that's important because a lot of the experience of a lot of non-Ashkenazi Jews in the United States is they feel very unaffirmed by the sort of ambient Judaism which exists. Right. And I think that's important to keep in mind, you know, that we, just because Judaism, Ashkenazi culture may have the plurality and the numbers, but that doesn't mean that it's the only one. And one more thing I just want to say on this point is that, you know, if you look at Jewish history and just learn about people's traditional attitudes, every group in history, every Jewish group always thinks they are the ones who are doing it right and everybody's doing it wrong. So that's also very valid.
It's very funny. I mean, it's a language that developed, as you said, over 1,000 years in so many different parts of Europe, right? That like there can't just be one way of doing it. I also try to say Jewish communities rather than say Jewish community. You know, when you work in the Jewish community, you hear that sort of monolithic thing. And of course, it just erases whatever the non-mainstream sort of idea is, right? And the more we talk about diversity in Jewish life and like really embracing the full diversity of the Jewish people, like language has to be a part of that because you have your Jews who spoke Ladino and your Jews who spoke Yiddish and all these different dialects of Yiddish. So what do you think about, we only just have a minute left. What do you think about why some words, this comes also from one of our viewers, why some Yiddish words make it into American popular culture, like TV and movies, and why others don't? Like, what is there something, is the transgressive nature of some of these words? Like,
ooh, that's a good question. I mean, obviously there has been for a long time this association of Yiddish with the vulgar because the vulgar things kind of find their way into popular culture. Now, I will say one aspect of that is that my understanding is in part, you couldn't say, you know, certain words on TV, let's say in the 50s, right? You still can't say them. However, you might've been able to say, you couldn't say like the F word, but you could say schmuck, for example, or some other word, which by the way, I don't like to say, I don't throw that word around lightly because it is incredibly offensive in Yiddish, right? Like it's very vulgar. And I'm a person, I like to swear, but I'm careful because I understand the different contexts. So I think that in a way, the vulgar became sort of useful for, you know, subverting mainstream American culture. Right. But also, you know, that's just pop culture, right? Like, I'm endlessly fascinated by the fact that Mike Myers on Saturday Night Live, you know, used this term, as he pronounced it, verklempt, right, with his Linda Richmond character, which is a, you know, mispronunciation of the Yiddish word, farklempt. Right. And he gave it a totally new meaning. Farklempt in Yiddish, in general, has a very negative meaning. It means that you're clenched, your heart is clenched. Like if it's located in the body, it's in the heart, not necessarily in the throat. So Linda Richmond always says, you know, she says, I can't talk, I'm verklempt, right?
Right.
So he moved, you know, the location of the Yiddish farklempt from the heart to the throat in a really fascinating way and brought that word into general use. Nobody used that word in American culture before Mike Myers introduced it, you know?
Right. I'm just watching the time. We're out of time. That's like yet another example in all these words and where they came from and the cultural creators who were part of American popular culture who were also growing up with Yiddish in the background. Like we could go on and on about this forever. We didn't get to talk about Fiddler on the Roof, which I really wanted to talk about and in Yiddish or not in Yiddish. But clearly we have to have another conversation at some point. I just want to thank you for being part of this one. And thanks to everyone who was here with us today. And just to remind everyone that they can find your article on our beautifully redesigned website at sapirjournal.org, where we have articles from all of our first 8 issues, of course, and recordings of events like these. And we also have a letters to the editor section now. There were a couple of letters about your article, and I would invite anyone who didn't get their question answered or have more comments that they want to share to send us a letter to the editor, and we'll publish some of those as well. So Rachel, thanks again for everything. Thank you for your beautiful piece and for all of your hard work, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.